A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those questions where the thing that makes it hard is also the thing that makes it urgent. He wants to know whether a durable peace between Israel and Lebanon is actually possible, and he says we can't answer that without disambiguating the Lebanese state from Hezbollah, because the two get talked about as if they're the same actor, and they're not. He's asking how deep Hezbollah's political and social embeddedness really goes, whether ordinary Lebanese civilians see it as a rogue militia or something more legitimate, and how real the division is between the formal Lebanese armed forces and Hezbollah on the ground.
The timing on this is not accidental. We just had something happen that hasn't happened in decades. A U.S.-brokered meeting between Israeli and Lebanese ambassadors face-to-face earlier this year. Ceasefire implementation is ongoing. And hanging over all of it is this one question nobody can answer definitively. Can the Lebanese state actually deliver on commitments when a non-state actor with its own army, its own social services, and its own political bloc operates inside its borders?
That's the whole thing right there. The conflation is the danger. You see headlines that say, Lebanon launches rockets, or Lebanon agrees to ceasefire terms, and the assumption baked into the grammar is that there's a single entity called Lebanon making decisions. But there isn't. There's a state apparatus, and then there's Hezbollah, and they are not the same thing. But they're also not fully separate. That ambiguity is the central unresolved variable in whether any peace framework can hold.
It's not just an academic distinction. If you negotiate a deal with the Lebanese government and Hezbollah decides it doesn't serve its interests, the deal is dead. That's not hypothetical. It's exactly what happened in 2006, when Hezbollah launched a cross-border raid that triggered a war, without the Lebanese government's approval. So the question Daniel's really asking is, who actually governs Lebanon, and can anyone govern it enough to make a peace agreement stick?
Beneath that, the question of legitimacy, because Hezbollah is not some outside force occupying Lebanese territory. It's woven into the political system. It runs hospitals and schools. It has members of parliament. For a significant portion of the population, it's not a rogue group. It's the most functional institution in their lives. That's what makes this harder than the standard state versus terrorist group framing.
So the arc here, I think, is, first, map out how Hezbollah became embedded, not just as a militia, but as a political and social institution. Then, look at what actually happens on the ground in South Lebanon, where the Lebanese armed forces and Hezbollah operate in the same territory, often cooperatively. And then, we can assess what all of this means for whether a durable peace is even theoretically possible.
Let's get into it.
The starting point for understanding this, and I think it's the part most outside observers miss, is that Hezbollah is not just a militia that happens to run some charities on the side. It is a parallel state infrastructure. We're talking about a network of hospitals, schools, construction firms, microfinance programs. In the Shia-majority areas of Lebanon, the south, the Bekaa Valley, the southern suburbs of Beirut, Hezbollah is often the most reliable service provider people have.
Which is less about Hezbollah's ambitions, and more about the Lebanese state's failures.
The Lebanese state has been hollowed out by decades of corruption, sectarian gridlock, economic collapse. When the banking system imploded in 2019 and 2020, when the currency lost over 90% of its value, it was Hezbollah's social welfare network that caught people who would otherwise have fallen through completely. So when we ask whether ordinary Lebanese civilians see Hezbollah as legitimate, the answer depends entirely on which Lebanese civilians you're talking about.
Daniel's question about the ordinary Lebanese civilian, that category doesn't really exist as a monolith. The polling bears this out. Surveys from 2024 and 2025 consistently show that among Lebanese Shia, support for Hezbollah's resistance role remains very high. We're talking 70-80% in some polls. But among Sunni and Christian communities, that number plummets. You're looking at single digits in some surveys.
That fracture is not just an opinion gap, it's a constitutional crisis. The TAIF agreement in 1990 ended the Lebanese civil war and explicitly called for the disarmament of all militias, all of them. But Hezbollah was carved out under the rationale that it wasn't a militia. It was a resistance force against Israeli occupation. That occupation ended in 2000. The exemption never did.
You have a situation where the foundational peace agreement of modern Lebanon says one thing, and the political reality says another, and nobody has the power or the will to resolve the contradiction.
That brings us to the Lebanese Armed Forces. The LAF is the official state military, funded in part by the US, trained by multiple Western countries, genuinely respected across sectarian lines as a national institution in a way that almost nothing else in Lebanon is. But here's the thing, the LAF does not confront Hezbollah. It coordinates with Hezbollah. In South Lebanon, the LAF, UNIFIL, and Hezbollah operate in a kind of triangular arrangement where everyone knows the rules and nobody tests them too hard.
That's the state within a state in practice. Not two enemies facing off, but two authorities sharing territory with an unspoken division of labor.
The thing is that division of labor isn't just about who patrols which road. It extends into the political system in ways that make disentangling them almost impossible without unwinding the entire post-war settlement. Hezbollah has been a formal political party since 1992. It runs candidates, it wins seats, it joins coalition governments. As of the 2022 elections, Hezbollah and its allies lost their parliamentary majority, but they retained a blocking third. So even when voters send a signal, the institutional design gives them veto power.
The blocking third is one of those details that sounds technical, but is actually the whole game. It means no cabinet can be formed without their consent. No major legislation passes without their sign-off. So even if you somehow got a Lebanese government that wanted to disarm Hezbollah, and that's a big if, Hezbollah could simply block the decision to the very democratic institutions it sits inside.
And that gets to the deeper mechanism Daniel's asking about. Why does this embeddedness persist? It's not just that Hezbollah has guns. It's that the Lebanese state is built on a sectarian power-sharing system where every community's political representation is tied to confessional identity. Hezbollah has positioned itself as the defender of the Shia community, not just militarily against Israel, but politically inside Lebanon. If you're a Shia family in the Bekaa and the state can't keep the electricity on, Hezbollah's construction arm is the one fixing the grid. If you need a hospital, Hezbollah runs several.
That's where the Al-Manar example gets instructive. Hezbollah operates its own satellite television network, its own radio stations, its own media ecosystem. Al-Manar doesn't just broadcast propaganda, it shapes the narrative about who provides and who fails. When the state collapses, Al-Manar is there to say, look who showed up, look who didn't.
The 2021 fuel crisis is the cleanest case study of this dynamic in action. Lebanon's economy was in freefall, fuel shortages were crippling the country, and the state was paralyzed. Hezbollah simply bypassed the government entirely, smuggled Iranian fuel shipments into Lebanon through Syria, and distributed them directly to its constituencies. The Lebanese state objected. Hezbollah demonstrated, in real time, that it could function as a sovereign actor, import, distribute, provide, while the official state watched from the sidelines.
Which is the paradox at the center of all this? The more the Lebanese state fails, the more Hezbollah's parallel infrastructure becomes indispensable to a third of the population, and the more indispensable it becomes, the harder it is to disarm or dismantle without causing a humanitarian crisis. The embeddedness is self-reinforcing.
That's the trade-off nobody wants to name out loud. If you push for Hezbollah's disarmament, through sanctions, through military pressure, through diplomatic isolation, you're not just targeting a militia. You're targeting the primary service provider for Lebanon's Shia community. You collapse that network, and you don't have a Lebanese state strong enough to replace it. So the people who would suffer most immediately are the very civilians the international community claims to be protecting.
The TAIF exemption isn't just a legal loophole that nobody got around to closing. It's the formal expression of a deeper reality. Lebanon's political system cannot resolve the Hezbollah question because Hezbollah is too integrated into the system for the system to function without it. That's the constitutional deadlock. You can't disarm Hezbollah without a national consensus. You can build a national consensus because the sectarian structure guarantees that Hezbollah's bloc has a veto over any consensus that threatens it.
The 2022 elections made this painfully visible. Hezbollah and its allies lost the majority, a genuine electoral shift, but the blocking third meant the result was gridlock, not reform. It took months to form a government. The status quo held. The system is designed to absorb dissent without changing.
When Daniel asks whether ordinary Lebanese civilians see Hezbollah as legitimate, the answer is that legitimacy is distributed along sectarian lines, but the institutional structure locks in Hezbollah's power regardless of where public opinion moves. That's the part that I think gets glossed over. It's not just a popularity contest, it's architecture. If that's the architecture inside Lebanon's political system, the question becomes what happens when you move south, to the actual terrain where any peace deal would have to be enforced. And that's where the LAF-Hezbollah relationship gets really strange.
Strange is the right word. Most people assume the Lebanese armed forces and Hezbollah are adversaries, or at least rivals. The reality on the ground in South Lebanon is much closer to coexistence, and in some cases, active coordination. The LAF doesn't try to disarm Hezbollah. It doesn't try to stop Hezbollah from operating south of the Litani. What it does is manage a triangular arrangement with Unifiel and Hezbollah, where everyone knows the boundaries and nobody crosses them in a way that forces a confrontation.
It's not a state controlling its territory. It's a state sharing sovereignty with a non-state actor, and the sharing is the mechanism that keeps the calm.
And UNIFIL is caught in the middle of this in a way that makes its mandate almost impossible to fulfill. UN Security Council Resolution 1701, passed after the 2006 war, calls for a zone south of the Litani River that is free of armed personnel who are not the Lebanese state or UNIFIL. That means no Hezbollah fighters, no Hezbollah weapons. But Hezbollah has maintained a presence there for years. The LAF's official position is that it cannot disarm Hezbollah without a national political consensus, which, as we just established, does not exist and structurally cannot exist under the current system.
The knock-on effect of that ambiguity is what Daniel's really driving at with the peace question. Any peace deal between Israel and Lebanon is inherently conditional on Hezbollah's consent. Even if the Lebanese government signs an agreement, Hezbollah's military wing can unilaterally decide to violate it. There's no mechanism inside the Lebanese state to prevent that.
We know this because it's already happened. The 2006 war was triggered by a Hezbollah cross-border raid into Israel, capturing two soldiers, killing others, and the Lebanese government had no prior knowledge and no ability to stop it. The state was dragged into a war. It didn't start by a non-state actor operating from its territory. That's not a historical footnote. That's the structural reality that any future peace framework has to contend with.
If you're Israel, or the US, or anyone trying to broker a deal, the problem is, who do you actually negotiate with? The Lebanese government can sign anything. But Hezbollah's military command retains independent decision-making authority over whether to honor it. That's not a peace partner. That's a peace partner with a veto held by someone outside the room.
Given all of that, the question becomes, what do you actually do about it? Because the standard playbook has been sanctions, military pressure, designating Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, and trying to squeeze it until it breaks. And that playbook has been running for decades. The result is that Hezbollah is more embedded now than it was when the squeeze started.
That's the actionable thing Daniel's getting at, whether he framed it that way or not. If the embeddedness is real and self-reinforcing, then treating Hezbollah as a purely military problem is not just insufficient, it's counterproductive. Every round of sanctions that collapses the Lebanese economy further makes Hezbollah's parallel service network more indispensable, not less.
I think the first practical shift that has to happen, and I'm not saying this is popular, but I think it's where the evidence points, is that the international community needs to start engaging with the political and social dimensions, not just the military one. You can't sanction away the primary healthcare provider for a third of the population and expect the population to turn against it. They'll turn against you instead.
The 2021 fuel smuggling episode is the perfect illustration. The US sanctions regime was designed to prevent exactly that, Iranian resources flowing into Lebanon through Hezbollah channels. And Hezbollah just did it anyway, publicly, while the state stood there. The sanctions didn't stop the shipment. What they did was make the Lebanese state look even weaker by comparison.
The second actionable piece is the LAF, and this is where I think the policy conversation has been stuck in a superficial place for years. The U.S. has poured something like $2.5 billion into the LAF since 2006, equipment, training, institutional support, and the LAF is more capable than it was. But capability is not the same as authority. You can give the LAF better rifles and better vehicles, but if it doesn't have political cover to assert itself in Hezbollah-dominated areas, none of that equipment matters.
Political cover meaning a Lebanese political consensus that says the LAF is the sole legitimate armed force and gives it the mandate to act like one, which, as we've established, doesn't exist and can't exist under the current sectarian architecture.
So, strengthening the LAF as a national institution isn't a procurement problem. It's a political problem that requires a political settlement inside Lebanon. And outside actors can't impose that from the outside. What they can do is stop undercutting it by treating the Lebanese state as a proxy battlefield.
For listeners who want to track whether any of this is actually shifting, there's a concrete thing to watch. The UNIFIL mandate renewal debates coming up in August. UNIFIL's mandate gets renewed annually by the Security Council, and every year it's a fight over whether to strengthen the monitoring mechanisms, whether to give it more enforcement teeth, whether to call out Hezbollah by name. The language in that resolution is a real-time indicator of where the international consensus is moving.
Alongside that, watch whether the U.S. posture shifts. The maximum pressure approach has been the default for years, sanctions, designations, squeezing Hezbollah's financial networks. But there's an emerging debate in policy circles about whether that approach has hit diminishing returns. If you start seeing language about political integration or incentive structures, instead of just countering Iranian proxies, that's a signal.
Not because anyone's gone soft on Hezbollah's military wing, but because the recognition might finally be dawning that you can't defeat an embedded social-political institution with tools designed for a clandestine terror cell. The category mismatch is the whole problem. Even with all of that, the policy shifts, the institutional reforms, the careful watching of UNIFIL mandate language, there's a question underneath it all that I don't think has a clean answer. Can a state that cannot control its own borders or disarm a non-state actor operating on its territory ever be a reliable peace partner?
I've been turning that over the whole time we've been talking, and I'm not sure the answer is yes in any traditional sense. Reliability implies the capacity to deliver. And the Lebanese state, as currently constituted, cannot guarantee that a commitment made in Beirut will hold in the Bekaa or south of the Litani. That's not a judgment on Lebanese intentions. It's a structural fact.
Then the question becomes whether the alternative is something other than full disarmament and full state control. A managed coexistence. A cold peace enforced by deterrence rather than trust. Both sides know the other can inflict enormous damage, and that knowledge keeps the temperature below boiling.
Which is not satisfying. Nobody wants to call that a durable peace. It's more like a durable stalemate. But it might be the most realistic outcome for the medium term, especially given that the constitutional deadlock inside Lebanon isn't going to resolve itself in the next year or two.
The next 12 to 18 months are going to test exactly this. If the U.S. brokered talks that produced that ambassadorial meeting earlier this year lead toward a framework agreement, the Hezbollah disarmament question becomes unavoidable. You can't negotiate borders and security arrangements without eventually having to answer, who controls the weapons on the Lebanese side?
If those talks collapse, if the framework doesn't hold, if the ceasefire frays, the region slides back into a cycle of escalation that we've seen play out before. Except this time, both sides have more sophisticated capabilities than they did in 2006. The stakes are higher.
The open question we're left with is whether the international community is willing to accept a Lebanon that functions as a kind of hybrid sovereign, a state with a non-state actor embedded in its political and security architecture, and negotiate accordingly. Because wishing that architecture away hasn't worked for 30 years, and it won't work for the next 30 either.
That's the thing to sit with, not whether peace is possible in the abstract, but whether the kind of peace that's possible is one the parties are willing to accept.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1953, Icelandic textile artist Guðrún Einarsdóttir produced the world's largest single panel of hand-dyed vaðmál, a traditional Norse woolen fabric, using a dye bath of native Icelandic moss that required 3 weeks of continuous simmering over geothermal vents.
I have so many questions about a dye bath simmering for 3 weeks.
I have questions about whether the moss was consulted.
This has been My Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.